We're speaking now with Cornell Razor, and he is our incumbent Republican legislator for Idaho Legislature House Seat B, District 1. Cornell, thank you for taking time to speak with us here today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
And an awful lot of people in town know you. You've had the Army Surplus Store for many years, and 45. You've been a county commissioner. Mm-hmm. But let's assume there's some folks listening that don't know about you. Tell us a bit about yourself, how you wound up here, and what you consider to be qualifications for being a legislator.
So my family's been here since the late 60s. I grew up here from youth all the way through teen, adult, young adulthood, and adulthood. We did move away for 1 year to the Oregon coast during the Jimmy Carter years when there was logging was shutting down because I was a logger at the time, but we moved right back. So I went to high school here. I've been involved in the local pro-life work for many, many years. I've been a board member there, and I'm kind of wandering around here, Chris.
That's fine, yeah.
Went to grade school at Northside, and then high school, junior high, and then high school here. Year in college, I was going to become a veterinarian, and I got married. So I ended up having to earn a living, and I still do the veterinary work on our small farm, but I don't get paid for it. So, and then got involved in politics years and years ago, back in the 80s and 90s, when using my property and running into property rights issues. And so I just began to get involved, and push came to shove, and I got involved in becoming a precinct committeeman back in the 90s, and then some local work helping local officials with what I could do. I've been involved in training parliamentary procedures for the state GOP and for local groups around the state. And then, let's see, what else? I was a county commissioner from 2009 to 2012. And then after that, I have the local Army Surplus Store, so I went back to work there. I've had that since 1981, and we purchased it in 2022. I worked there from 81 to 22 for the original owner. He started it in 73, so it's been in continuous business for 53 wow. years now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now we're in Ponderay. We had to move to Ponderay. And then I was elected to the state house. Actually, I wasn't elected. I ran and won the primary in 2024. And then along about August, Sage Dixon was offered a different responsibility by the governor, by the state government, I should say. I don't know who the actual offer came from. And he called me and said, if I step down, would you be willing, if you get appointed, to take over for me? Well, the way that works is the local central committee, and I said, sure, Sage, I'll be glad to do that. So the local central committee gets together and they create a list of three names, and then they send that to the governor. Well, I was the winner of the primary that year, so I was probably the presumptive winner of the general election. So Governor Little appointed me to take Sage's seat September of 2024. So it looks like I'm a two-termer, but I'm not. I'm a 1.25 termer. So
okay, if you want to get technical about it,
yeah.
Okay.
So that ends up, I just finished my second session, my first 2 year stint as an elected state rep, and I'm here running again.
Well, the perennial question is, why are you running again?
So I discovered that sometimes the best way to be able to help more people is to get in a position of responsibility so that you can help more people at one time. And so some of my most satisfying work I do is when constituents call with well issues or easement issues, which I've helped with, or child welfare issues, things like that. And I'm actually able to help people a little bit. So becoming a state legislator gave me the opportunity to look at different kinds of legislation. One of the bills I'm going to run if I get back in. It's a simple little bill that has to do with courts and stamping documents so that when you go to court and receive the documents after your court case is over, everything's, you can make sure that everything's there. Simple stuff like that. A lot of state legislation is that way. But I get to help people. I get to go before them and make their way straight. So that's kind of what I enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm. And the legislature deals with a ton of legislation every year. I think I saw 300 bills this year.
350.
Yeah, passed 350 bills that came before the legislators to deal with, which is sounds like a lot of homework to me.
Well, actually, it was way more than that. 1,367 pieces of legislation were written. Documents were written. 813 bills and were gathered by LSO, and then we ended up with 350 signed pieces of legislation. I think it was 354 or 352.
Well, that kind of begs the question: how do you keep up with all that?
15-hour days.
Mm-hmm. A lot of reading, I presume.
A lot of reading, mm-hmm. And much reading twice. Some of the bills, the majority of Idaho legislation, and I've discovered other state legislations as well in different states, is fixing the mistakes in past legislation. And sometimes that fix is five words or a number or a corrected number. And so much of the legislation I read, I should have kept track of it because since I read every single one of them, but much of it is 1 and 2 pages, mm-hmm. and relatively simple. I think I had 162-page bill and 179-page bill, several 40-page bills, and some 30-page bills, but mostly 6 pages and less. But what the work comes in when you read the bill, and I didn't bring any with me, but there'll be references to other legislation that are it's going to affect, especially in the title. You read the title, and it'll usually tell what other legislation that's going to affect. And so you have to look into that as well. And when it comes to funding, you have to look into the budget book, which is an 851-page monstrosity that you have to dig into to see how the budget will be affected. Also, phone calls. I was going to run a coroner bill, and I called our coroner, got his opinion on it, and put it back in my drawer until I get a chance to spend time with him and kind of pound out the inaccuracies that were in it. I called the city council called the mayor. Check with the mayor on a bill. I check with the county commissioners. So some of it is just getting advice. When it comes to funding bills, I know several members who are legislators who are members of JFAC, the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, which is a set of 10 House members and 10 Senate members who put together the budget for us to look at and then either pass or reject. And I will ask those people questions because they're in the middle of it, and they have working groups. Thus, JFAC has several working groups that get together aside from the JFAC meetings and then hammer out what's going to actually go into each budget. Health and welfare, for example, probably has 30 budgets, 20 budgets. I'm guessing.
Within that department.
You know, there's public wealth, healthcare, and public health, and there's Medicaid, and there's just all different sub-budgets in the health and welfare budget. And so it's fine, it's good when you can talk to someone who was on the working group who hammered out that particular budget. So that's one of the other things you have to do. So it takes time, but I don't have anything else to do. That's what I was sent down to do.
That's the job too, right? Well, I want to get into some of the specific legislation that came up this year.
Okay.
But is there anything coming up that you want to get involved with? You mentioned the court stamp bill. Sounds like a simple one, but are there some issues that you want to get involved in that you want potential voters to know about?
So there's a couple of things coming up. One of them is going to be a sound money bill. We had several sound money bills that were put in drawers. And so we're going to work on those. Now, I didn't come up with those. A senator came up with that, but I've worked with him on them over the years, or years past, and I will continue to do that should I get reelected. There's a bill on protecting public access to public lands. And I ran it two sessions ago, my first session, and it was killed in committee because of great misunderstandings. Well, I didn't have time this time, but I intend to pick that back up and contact the county that was most concerned about it and see if I can put to bed some of their concerns. Sometimes that's what it is. It's a matter of finding out where the objections are and then meeting with the objectors and finding out what their objections are and can we hammer them out. So That's another piece of legislation.
Can I ask on that one? I know there's been a lot of debate in the state, all around the state, for actually many years, about Idaho assuming control of federal lands, specifically Forest Service, BLM lands. Are you in favor of that? And then I think a question that comes along with that is, how do we ensure that the financial costs of managing those lands, specifically wildfire is a big expense now, is something that doesn't actually end up costing the state?
So yes, I'm a proponent of it. This bill I'm talking about had nothing to do with that.
This is maintaining this public access to the way it's set up currently.
Correct. Yeah. What the situation is county commissioners, road districts, if there's a public access to a public land and they are maintainers of that public access, they can choose not to maintain it. They can shut it down. Mm-hmm. Well, what this bill would simply do is require them to provide other public access, either by the county assuming and providing it or mm-hmm. a developer providing it, one or the other, whichever works best for the county mm-hmm. or the road district. And so the concerns on that were varied. I thought I answered them all. I received a 10-page or a 10-question, a 10-concern questionnaire from the Idaho Association of Counties. I answered every single one of them, and there were still some concerns, but that's another story for another time. So first of all, if the state begins to manage those lands, they will reap the benefits, the grazing fees, the mining fees, the royalties that the federal government currently reaps. And that would be used to fund the state doing them. It would be just like business. If you decide to start stocking a new pair of shoes, new kind of shoes, you use some of the money from the existing shoes to fund the new shoe. And then once it gets up on its, I know this is kind of arcane, but once it gets up on its own feet, if you will, no pun intended, it provides its own way. Same thing with timberland and mining and grazing in Idaho, which we have lots of. Those particular royalties are not coming to the state of Idaho now, and they would if the state took control of the lands. It would have to be done piecemeal. That is something that is being worked on and looked at. It's not as simple as I would have liked it to be, but it's a very possibility, a very distinct possibility that it could happen.
And I assume at that level, the Congress would have to weigh in.
There would have to be protections against losing the land to developers, things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, all the concerns that people are raising, we're hearing those. Mm-hmm. We're hearing those concerns.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk about some of the stuff that came up in this legislative session that ended just in, I think, end of March.
2nd of April. 81 days, I think.
Yeah, actually more compact than some of the mm-hmm. more recent sessions, and a big thing for the state to work on was the budget, because we were coming up short on the budget, and we of course have a constitutional requirement that we balance our budget mm-hmm. each year, and the legislature and Governor Little enacted a series of bills for budget cuts that reduce funding for most state agencies and departments by 4% this year, 5% starting in fiscal 2027, which is only starts in July. And now that's a whole series of bills. We can't get into all the different ones there, but it seems like it's mostly like pretty much a across the board cut on most agencies. It wasn't real specific to individual agencies. I guess one question would be, you know, it's across the board budget cut, the best way to do it. Some agencies probably have more fat, if you will, than others. And then one bill that affected the budgets of many agencies was House Bill 559, which conforms retroactively to the federal tax changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that the Trump administration signed into law. So give us your take on, first of all, how do you vote on that House Bill 559? And then just the whole budgeting process, trying to get the budget down to meet revenues.
So I'll try to tackle those concerns as I remember them. I'm getting old and I may not remember them all. You can help me. I voted yes. The bill, as I dug into it, began to look at the particular exemptions and budgetary concerns that would help Idahoans. It benefited 91% of the rank and file Idahoans. Didn't benefit corporations so much, but some. But the average with the wage tax removal on tips and overtime, those kinds of things, that helps 90, among other things, those aspects of the 559 helped 91% of Idahoans. So it was an across-the-board, you talk about across-the-board, it was an across-the-board benefit to the regular Idahoan, the people that are paying the taxes in this state that cover health and welfare and school and law enforcement and public lands or maintenance of lands. So, okay, so that the one question was, how did I vote? I said I voted for it. Part of the reason was because of the benefit to 91% of the rank and file in Idaho. And then what ended up happening is JFAC did not do, there was an across-the-board cut demand by the governor. And then what happens with JFAC is they dig into each budget individually. And so some of those budgets didn't get as much of a cut. Some of them got as much or a little bit more. But what ended up happening is there's two sections of budgeting now. There's the maintenance budget. This is the budget that keeps the lights on. And if you look at my voting record, you'll see I voted for every single one of those. Whether it was education or law enforcement or veterans or whatever, I voted for every single one of those. Then there's a secondary budget called the enhancement budget. Some of the enhancement budgets, and I don't have them cataloged in my mind right now because there were so many, but put back into the budget the rescissions that were made in the maintenance budgets in some departments, including education and health and welfare. I did see that. And so just be aware that it's not when you hear the story that there was a 5% across the board, that's not accurate. Because JFAC looked at each bill, each budget individually, and then made decisions based on the working group's information that they brought back to the major, the main committee. So does that answer?
Yes, yeah, sure.
Okay.
I understand. They had a bunch. In fact, mm-hmm. I think I read a little bit about that.
Yeah.
They had
so yes, there was a series of cuts, 3%, 4%, 5%. Mm-hmm. But then each budget was also looked at individually mm-hmm. and adjusted as necessary.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of as an add-on to mm-hmm. that main legislation. Okay. Well, while we're on the budget, so what do you see happening with state revenues coming up or going down? Because, well, I mean, that's the big controller here.
Yeah, the April is the big month in the state because it's tax month. So when we get to the end of April, actually, it'll be probably the second week of May when we'll know the numbers. We'll have a much better prognostication as to how the budget's going to fare. There's cause for optimism from what I'm told from the people who follow this regularly and have been for decades, that it looks like maybe the state's going to be just fine. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that we don't need to take much care this coming 2028 session, you know, for figuring the budget for 2028. But what will have to be done for 2027, I think there was projected $155 million balance left over after all the bills were paid for 2027. So, and $67 million for 2026, which isn't as big as normal, but so far it looks like we're on schedule mm-hmm. to have that happen.
Mm-hmm. And Idaho does have and we're a fast-growing state, so.
Right. Actually, I think we just took over from Texas as being by percentage the fastest-growing state.
Fastest-growing, yeah. Yeah. We've been right up in the top three for years.
Chris, shh.
I'm with you on that. If we could somehow, you know, slow it down. Okay, well, let's talk about some other bills and how you fell out on these. House Bill 913 called for the state to implement work requirements by the end of the year for adults that are enrolled in the Medicaid expansion in order to receive those benefits. It did pass. Mm-hmm. And what was your posture on that one?
So I voted for it. I have no problem with the work requirements. If folks are going, able-bodied adults are going to be receiving Medicaid benefits. How do I say this without sounding, you have to make choices as a legislator. And so as I'm looking at the able-bodied adults compared to people who have been on Medicaid for quite some time and have really, really difficult circumstances to live with. You know, I want to make sure that those folks are getting their what they need. And so requiring work benefits or work requirements, reporting, and also I believe you can put in, what do they call it when you, community service. Mm-hmm. Community service also serves to satisfy those concerns. It seems that it's appropriate to do that with able-bodied adults so that we can make sure that our most needy are guaranteed that they will get their Medicaid payments. And it looks to me like 913 did as much of that as possible. Now, what you'll find is if I get reelected, I'll probably be voting on a cleanup bill for 913, because that's just how this thing works. We like to think that we get it fixed the first time, but unfortunately that doesn't
work. So they'll come back and be, you anticipate there'd be
guessing.
Adjustments, yeah.
I have no inside baseball to say that other than just from what I've seen.
Is there an adjustment you'd like to see?
Nothing that I can think of right now.
Okay, well, let's move on because we are going to run out of time before we know it. House Bill 561, it was a bill which called for a $2,000 a day fine for governments that entities that fly unapproved flags on government property. Now, this was of concern in Bonner's Ferry because Bonner's Ferry for years has flown a Canadian flag. When the bill was approved as it was, it would have barred Bonner's Ferry from flying the Canadian flag, but then an addendum got added to that.
Senator Woodward did that. Yeah, yeah.
That came back and allowed, under certain circumstances, if there's a historic tie to for reasons of flying it. Anyways, it was finessed so that Bonner's Ferry can keep flying the Canadian flag. They're a closest city to the Canadian border, but it does require other entities like Boise to stop flying the LGBTQ pride flag. So there was some controversy or discussion about this. How did you fall out on House Bill 561?
Well, I didn't look at it as much as an interdiction, but just as a standardizing around the state so that government institutions fly flags that are government related, whether they be school district, tribal, military, and those are flags that everybody can agree on. And that way we don't have our cities and our municipalities and our counties being involved in displaying things that might not have the approval of all the citizens. So I just looked at it as a standardizing around the state, and the state has a compelling interest often for property rights and for these kinds of things in making sure that everybody's concerns are met. This reduces the number of flags that will be flying from government flagpoles, just government flagpoles.
That's right.
Just government institutions.
Yeah. Private people can fly whatever they want.
Private people can fly whatever they want. And as long as I'm breathing, I'll make sure they can.
Okay, let's squeeze in one more question, maybe two. House Bill 583, it restricts local government's ability to impose rules on short-term rentals. And that was of concern here in Sandpoint because Sandpoint previously had a limit of 35 short-term rentals in the state. And this loosened that up. It basically made it so that these local governments can't impose these kind of rules. How did you go on House Bill 583?
So I believe that 583 ensures proper. I'm going to be reading some, Chris, because I had a lot of questions about this. And So I composed a standardized answer. It ensures proper local control by curbing overregulation and safeguarding property rights. It maintains proper local control by allowing counties and cities to enact reasonable regulations for public health, safety, and welfare as long as they align with uniform standards from the Idaho Building Code Board and the International Building Codes. Locals can specify require specific safety measures, smoke alarms, sleeping areas, fire extinguishers, CO2 detectors, escape ladders, etc. I don't read the whole thing. It restrains overregulation by prohibiting ordinances that discriminately target rentals, which comprise 1% of the market. 1%. So the angst was over a very small percentage of the market. And I saw 583, which was a collaboration over 3 years, that seem to satisfy the concerns of local control and property rights. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are running out of time officially. I'm going to squeeze in one more.
That's fine.
Oops, Sorry sure. about that. That's our
time. And you can edit out. You can edit out my long-winded stuff. Yeah.
So Cornell, on the question of local control, there it's kind of a philosophical question, I suppose, because the state comes in to do kind of statewide legislation that doesn't always fit local circumstances. What's your philosophical feeling about the legislature passing uniform laws that mandate how all Idaho communities handle those sorts of situations?
So the state has a compelling interest in making sure that genuine property rights are not abrogated. And so when that is brought to our attention by constituents throughout the state, and 583, our attention was drawn to property rights violations throughout the entire state. I won't name the cities because I don't want to cast any onus on people, mayors or anything else. But so to create standardized regulation that allows people to have the ability to know what they're going to be looking at no matter where they go, in certain instances, like I was talking about here, safety measures, general ordinances, noise, nuisance, parking, curfew, traffic rules, which are enforceable through police and even levy fines on violators. Those kinds of things should remain local. But to make sure that people's property rights are not arbitrarily being violated because a city wants to pass a local ordinance that does that, that's a state responsibility.
Okay, Cornell Razor, we're out of time. Incumbent and candidate for Idaho Legislature District 1, House Seat B. How do people get a hold of you if they want to find out more about your candidacy?
So they can go to the Idaho Legislature's website, and my contact information is there. My mailing address, my legislative email. I have a Substack. I have a Facebook page. I put out during the session, I put out what I call session report, and I would report on each week about a 3,000-word report of what happened that week, what the main bills were, what the concerns were, how I voted and why I voted. And I've had a lot of good result, a lot of good people have really appreciated it, let me put it that way.
Well, Cornell Razor, thank you for taking time to speak
with
us.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.